Hi, I'm Keren, and this is The Divine Feminist, a podcast about putting the magic and the common sense of balance back at the very center of our world, and along the way reconnecting with the perfect spark of usness that's always been waiting outside of the boxes and the shoulds of society, ready to bring us back to ourselves. Thank you so much for joining me. Let's get going. Hello and welcome back to The Divine Feminist. It's been a few weeks since our last episode, but if you're listening to these as they come out, you would definitely be forgiven for thinking it's been months. Here in the UK, like a lot of the world, we're still in lockdown due to COVID-19, and it's just a really interesting time. Time seems to be moving, well, of its own accord, really. And the stuff that's going on behind the scenes under the surface is deep, is powerful, is bringing up a lot for people. So I wanted to remind you before I get on to this week's episode about the fact that it's important to take care of yourself. Like I said last time, that the do's and the musts and the shoulds, the vast majority of them will wait. During this time, as we're trying to find our feet in the new normal and preparing for whatever the next new normal is once lockdowns are over and we get back out into the world, it's really important that more than anything else, you look after yourself and give yourself what you need. With that in mind, let me tell you a little bit about today's episode and the wonderful guest that I'm so excited for you to meet. As with our last guest conversation, I did think about putting this one on pause just until we move out of this liminal period that we're in and back out into the world, but it just didn't feel right to do that. I listened to the conversation and was really struck by the fact that even though we had it weeks and weeks before lockdown began, it was quite pertinent for certainly what I've been experiencing right now, and I think what a lot of other people are experiencing too, if my clients and my friends and my family members are anything to go by. It also struck me that as we prepare to move back out into the world and, as I say, to create some sort of new normal, however that looks, we need to make sure that we're doing that consciously. We're doing that in a way that keeps us safe, not just physically, but in all of the ways. And so this conversation felt really poignant for that too. And really deep. I enjoyed every moment of it. I think towards the end I call it juicy, and that's the best description I can give you because there was just so much in there that I wanted to take away and reflect on, journal on. So I hope that you find it just as powerful. My guest today is Jane Claire Bradley. Jane is the integrative counselling practitioner behind Rebel Therapy, which I love. Jane is a writer, a performer, and the runner of creative writing workshops and writing retreats here in the UK. She also hosts a regular monthly spoken word night called That's What She Said in Manchester, although I believe at the moment they've taken that online. Jane and I came together to talk about the subject of trauma, but of course our conversation wandered into all sorts of other fields, as conversations have a tendency to do. So without further ado, sit back, have a listen, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this episode. Hi Jane, welcome to The Divine Feminist. It is so lovely.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Before we get started, tell me a little bit about you. Tell me a little bit about your work.
With pleasure. So I have a private counselling practice that I launched just towards the end of last year, Rebel Therapy. And I'm an integrative practitioner. So I use a mix of person-centred, transactional analysis and CBT. Approaches within that to sort of support people, facilitate their therapeutic process, whatever that might look like for them, kind of exploring where they are, what they might be struggling with, where they might like to be, and anything that sort of might be in the mix around that. So it could be stuff from the past, it might be stuff that they're exploring in the present, it might be fears around the future. So we kind of look at all of that and then sort of feel our way through it together. So my role in that kind of being facilitating and supporting them in that. I'm a writer, a performer. I put on a monthly spoken word night here in Manchester. That's called That's What She Said. So it's for women and non-binary writers. I teach creative writing workshops, and I also, as of last year, started doing regular writing retreats in the Peak District, which is lovely because it's not far from where I am, only sort of an hour or so in the car, but feels like another world. So that's really lovely to get that option to have a bit of space and a bit of writing time and nature time and all of that is right up my right on my street. That is me picturing the trees in the Peak District.
I love it. I quite like the idea of a writing retreat up a tree, to be honest.
Yeah, that was like a bit of inner child work there, I think, that I, when I was little, used to have my favourite tree that I used to go and sit up in and read and do a little bit of notebook scribbling. So maybe.
I love the fact that on your website, you talk about specifically how you work a lot with creatives in your therapy work. And I love the fact that those two things tie together, that you tie your therapy work with, because I have known you via Instagram for a good, probably 2-3 years now as the writer person, as the person who runs the spoken word nights, who teaches creative writing. And so I love the fact that you bring those things together, not least because last month on The Divine Feminist, we were talking all about creativity. So I'm just wondering, kind of, was the link between working with creative people in therapy and being a creative person yourself, was that kind of intentional or did it just come about?
I think it was intentional in the sense of coming to sort of think about my private practice and think about who my ideal client group would be. That seemed really exciting to me because I guess I'd done so much of supporting creatives in other ways, so not necessarily therapeutically, but a bit therapeutically. I guess that was the thing, that in teaching creative writing and in holding those sort of performance spaces, I'd seen so much and talked so much with so many people about kind of the sort of power of that catharsis through creativity and how that can be so powerful to be seen and to share your stuff, but also it can be really vulnerable, and how you can make that safe, or how do you hold it when it feels unsafe, and how it can be a really powerful way to connect to a community and find subculture and find sort of your family, for want of a better word, and how it can connect to sort of identity, and how that can be amazing and so powerful to kind of claim those bits of your identity, but also if that challenges some of what you've been taught, be it by family, be it through culture, about what success should be and what you should do with your time and what is okay to do. So even the idea of lots of people, I mean, I'm from a working class background, and there was a lot of messaging in my family around sort of don't draw attention to yourself, put your head down, work hard, don't tell anyone your business. So when I've started synthesizing performance and getting up on stage and telling quite raw stories sometimes about things that have happened to me, even if it's through the vehicle of fiction, there's a lot of truth in it, because, you know, that's art, isn't it? It's truth through fiction. So I can't say it was necessarily intentional in that it was a grand master plan from the start, but there was absolutely a bit of recognizing sort of, I think, where my strengths were and also where my excitement was, where my curiosity was, and being able to facilitate that has always felt like such a massive privilege in the work that I've done in other spaces and other roles. So getting to do it in a therapeutic space, which sometimes can feel like where so much responsibility is, but so much magic and so much power to kind of tap into old patterns and rewrite old patterns, it just seemed to be like a really powerful cauldron to transfer all my understanding of creativity and creative paths and creative identities and use that in a therapeutic context. Seem like it was where I should be.
I'm kind of sitting here and as you're talking I'm just going yes. Yes, I love that, because I think it's such a powerful thing. I mean, it's funny, before we started recording we were talking about your novel, your writing, and we mentioned the word therapy and then said, oh, that was a Freudian slip, we meant writing. And it's funny because actually when we create there is something so powerfully therapeutic, as you say, and cathartic about being able to create, to get the stories out, which inevitably are influenced by our personal background, but also to be seen and to be heard and to be witnessed for those stories. But equally, again, as you say, like there's something so vulnerable about that. And I resonate so deeply with what you say about that. I mean, I'm a little bit further north and a bit further east than you, but that working class northern background, I think, which is, and I think this is one in a lot of working class backgrounds, which is, no, you keep your head down, you do your work. I adopted a bit of a Geordie accent as I said that. You keep your head down, you do your work, and you don't draw attention to yourself. And actually, what's needed is the voices from all of those different parts of society and I mean, I'm aware I say this as somebody with an awful lot of privilege anyway, but from all of those different parts of society to stop keeping their head down and playing small and to have their voices heard. And there is something so therapeutic about that.
So much so. You've hit the nail on the head, that idea of that we can claim our stories, and not only will do that, that do so much for us in terms of healing whatever we might be carrying. I think it does have a real ancestral benefit in that, to do that, to be the first one to kind of break that silence that might have been encoded almost on a DNA level for generations, like that is a powerful thing to do. For ourselves, for our ancestors, but also it has such an important function in terms of supporting future generations, be they our sort of literal kind of our family trees, next branches as it were, but on a collective level, I think, you know, that modeling, if you tell your story, the people that that can connect to, it's that that can catalyze so many other people feeling empowered to tell their story. And like you say, us using our privilege that then might allow someone else whose story might be even more needed or even not more not represented in culture as we have it at the moment, if that allows them to feel that bit of permission, feel that strength, feel that that they're not going to be alone in doing that, I think that is really important as well.
So much so. And I love the fact that you, in bringing together the threads of your magic, in putting that all in your cauldron, as you say, that you can not only witness that and help people with that, but you can hold, really hold safe space, safe therapeutic space for them while they do that and to do that. And I think that's, it's such a gift. Such a gift. I love it.
I hope so. Thanks.
So tell me, your private practice is called Rebel Therapy, which I absolutely love. I remember the first time I saw it on Instagram being like, that is awesome. And I love the fact that it, on your website, when you talk about it, you talk about, you know, this is about bringing together the people from the subcultures, from the parts of society that aren't sort of seen as the norm, as the way that they should be, the way that, as you say, your family society will tell us we should go about our lives, the people that we should be in our lives. And I wonder for you, kind of as somebody who, and I'm quoting or subquoting this from your website, is somebody who has operated on the fringes of society in some ways. I wonder, how do you think that helps you in your therapy work?
That's a great question. And I hope it does. And I think the responses that I've had from people have really shown that it has spoken to people, which has been incredibly validating, because when I launched it initially, I just had no idea. It was a big leap of faith of whether that was going to be sort of a language and a position that would connect with people. So it has been really exciting and heartening that people seem to have received it in the spirit that it's been intended. And I think what's been important about it for me is this idea that it would kind of support that sense of like pride and empowerment in different identities that people might have, be that a specific subculture, a specific faith system, a sexuality, a type of career, a type of relationship, you know, especially if those aspects of identity are things that they might have experienced judgment or rejection for in other parts of kind of society. So that absolutely, from personal experience, it's been something that has been really important for me, you know, from being really young and then into becoming an adult and sort of recognizing what I want my role in society to be and all that kind of stuff. There's been a lot in that around getting rid of shame that I might have carried around to certain aspects of my identity, shall we say. So that idea of being working class was something I carried so much internalized shame around for years, of like having been brought up in poverty, and being queer is something I'm so proud of and feel so empowered by now, and it gives me so much, you know. I'm very lucky that the queer community here in Manchester is just incredible. It's so familial, so supportive. It's a beautiful thing. And I think if I had continue to maybe reject or minimize that in myself, I would have missed out on so much. So actually being able to claim those things and have them be validated as things that are superpowers rather than weaknesses or anything to be afraid of or ashamed of has been so personally important that if I can sort of support that and validate that for my clients, that feels like an incredibly valuable thing to be able to do.
Yes, that's so beautiful. So beautiful. And do you know, one of the things I love about when you when you define almost how you see that word rebel on your website, and you talk about the working class side of things, you talk about the queer community, you talk about, as you did before, with your performance nights, you talk about it being for women and for non-binary people. And so, you know, to be able to open up avenues, to be able to help people as somebody who operates from those same communities, I think is such a beautiful, such a powerful thing. I also love the fact that you talk about, when you're talking about rebels, you talk about punk, you talk about those countercultures, if you like, that are not, that we might not have to tick a box on a census or a survey to say yes, this is who I am, but they're such an important part of identity, that the culture that we associated with are such an important part of identity. And I love that you call that out on your website too.
Well, thank you. And I think that's so right, this idea of we are multidimensional beings, and you know, sometimes what we do as a job might be a really great representation of who we are and what's important to us, but not always, depending on who we are and what stage we're at and what means are available to us. So that idea of, you might work in a coffee shop, but actually your band that you run, or your, you know, pagan sort of family that you do rituals with every weekend, or whatever it is, they might feel more important to you, or just as important. And that idea of, that's okay to recognize that, you know, we live in a culture that doesn't always see us as multidimensional beings, especially, we could do a whole other episode like on critiquing capitalism and what sort of our value in terms of productivity and all of that. And actually, you know, there's so much to people that we miss if we only think in those terms. And I think just allowing, making it explicit maybe gives permission for clients to bring it into the session as well. Yeah. One of the things I was really concerned about when I launched the practice was this idea of, maybe my peers or the counsellors and therapists I know might be offended that perhaps this sort of like implied suggestion, certainly not my intention, but an implied suggestion that they weren't able to serve those clients, which is not what I'm saying at all. But I think by me making it explicit and making it part of the conversation before the client sent the first email or picked up the phone, hopefully it minimises the risk for them, or the feeling of risk for them, in bringing it up. So I had one client who came to me, talked about having quite a lot of experience of therapy and counselling, and when they came to me, were ready to talk about aspects of their sexuality that they'd never talked about with other counsellors or therapists that they'd had. And what I want to really make clear is, I'm not saying those other therapists wouldn't have understood it. Nope. I'm sure they would have been amazingly empathic, non-judgmental. I'm sure they would have been able to do an incredibly compassionate and powerful job of holding space for this client. But for whatever reason, be it more cultural cues rather than those specific counselors or therapists specifically, they didn't feel able until they came to a space where it was almost the rainbow flags on the door before you walk in. Not, you know, metaphorically, and that being the thing that sort of pushed them over the line into, okay, I can trust this space, I can trust this person. So I think it's that making it explicit that it is safe and is not going to lead to rejection or judgment, hopefully makes them feel safer to sort of share. And then I just think you can have a more trusting relationship and ultimately be able to kind of go deeper and further in the work. So hopefully it only does good.
I hear what you're saying so deeply on so many levels. And I think, well, I'm aware you don't need to be validated, but as one of your peers, I guess, I read what you say and think that's awesome, because I think that's something I've struggled with too. I put out there on my website that the work I do is therapy, but it's very spiritually focused, it's very soul focused. And I have often felt the same thing. Are there going to be other therapists out there who look at that and go, is she saying that I can't handle that? Is she saying that I'm not aware enough to deal with that? And that's not it at all. However, do you know what? There's enough space out there in the world for all of us to do the thing that is our thing, in the way that is bringing together all of our magic and stirring up in our own cauldrons, to go back to your metaphor before. And actually, when you're safe enough in what your own thing is, and that's not to say that you don't take in clients from who are different to you, of course. But when you're safe enough in sort of the specialist space that you can hold, I guess, then you can do that, and you can really, really help those clients who find a home that they otherwise would never have found that therapeutic home before.
That's so Great to hear you say that. Thank you, Karen. And I really want to reflect as well that you were a really great model, actually, when I was setting up my private practice, because I think the way you talk about yourself and your practice is so brave. And I think it really speaks to your integrity and your confidence in what you do. And I think that is only going to make clients feel safer, as we've said. And, you know, if someone, you can trust that someone feels secure in who they are and what they're offering, that's going to make a client feel much safer. I would hope that what they are and what they do is going to be recognized, held, witnessed, treated with respect, treated with understanding, because, you know, you're modeling that in what you are and what you do. So I think that is really part of it, I think, definitely.
Thank you so much for what you just said. I fear we are in danger of a little therapist loving, but I'm not going to complain. Thank you. But I love what you said about it's that integrity piece, isn't it? In reality, it doesn't matter who we are, because we are all our own selves. What matters is that whoever we are, however we identify ourselves in all of the different facets of that, we can keep our integrity in that, in the way we show up, in the way we work, in who we are. And that's not always easy.
No, but I think that is part of it. The fact that we do it despite it not being easy is really powerful, you know. And I think there's something in that exploring, who told you couldn't be this? Who told you couldn't have your spirituality inform who you are as a counsellor? Right down to through sort of certain clients are still holding things around, people being told that they can't dress a certain way when they're teenagers, or that they can't have relationships a certain way, or that their sexuality isn't what it should be, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. You know, so exploring how it can feel risky to do something that's maybe a bit different, and to do it anyway, and that's still with thought and still with consideration. But I think there is really something in that it's carving out its own space, and that's really needed.
100%. And I think that's in everything, isn't it? You know, we're talking about our experience as therapists, but that is, it goes for us, it goes for our clients, it goes for everybody and everything that they do. It's about looking past those shoulds and those cannots and that shame, and actually just showing up in the world in spite of all that, and saying, here's who I am and here's what I'm here to do, is such a powerful thing.
Yeah, very that.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this idea of trauma, because I think trauma is something that we are now hearing a lot about in society, and rightly so. I think that's really important. But tell me from your experience in terms of working with clients, from your knowledge, your wisdom, what does trauma mean to you before we start talking about it? Big question, isn't it?
It's such a big question, and there's so many textbooks and answers, and a lot of them are, although very well intentioned, quite limiting. So I'm going to share the one that I really like, which is by Peter Levine, who wrote Waking the Tiger. And it's this idea of trauma being something, anything that is too much, too soon, or too fast for our nervous system to handle.
Oh, I like that a lot.
And I love that because it's so subjective, whereas a couple of others, or when I was training and reading all these sort of academic and textbooks around it, a lot of definitions of trauma talk about things that are beyond usual experience. But what does that mean? You know, usual experience is not a universal experience. You know, one person's usual experience could be a million miles away, you know, literally, geographically, as well as mentally, emotionally, all that kind of thing, from someone else's usual experience. So I don't think that is necessarily very helpful. A lot of definitions talk about kind of things that are distressing. And again, there is a lot of truth to that, but not every distressing, quote unquote, event is traumatic for every person. So there's something also about the link between resilience and kind of predisposing factors that might mean someone is more impacted by an event that could be considered traumatic. There's so much in it. It's really multidimensional, again, to go back to that. So I like this idea of too much, too soon, too fast, because it's subjective. You know, what's too much, too soon, or too fast for me might be really different to what's too much, too soon, or too fast for you. But it validates that idea. I think my personal sort of beliefs and working definition around trauma is this idea of something that is too much for us to handle, and too much for us to process, too much for us to understand, be it from a bodily perspective, from a mental perspective, from an emotional perspective. It's too much for us to know what to do with. And that's when all these sort of trauma symptoms that people can experience are usually to do with that idea of trying to understand something that's happened. So there's a lot of writing around how trauma symptoms like flashbacks or nightmares are actually an attempt to kind of process a memory that's been too much for us to understand in our waking experience. But, you know, that unconscious memory is still sort of sifting through it and trying to process it, contextualize it, reach an understanding around it. There's a lot of writing that I really like around it being sort of an incomplete threat response. So trauma being usually a time where we've had this kind of version of a threat response. So fight, flight, freeze, hide. Mm-hmm. We've had a situation that's necessitated that, but it's for whatever reason, we've not kind of completed the response. So this idea of then it's coming up in situations where maybe it's not needed. So panic or social anxiety, you know, that version of feeling like something's going to happen. I feel like I'm going to explode. I feel like I'm going to die if I'm in a room with more than 10 people in.
Yeah.
You know, that's a version of fight, flight, freeze, hide. It's all those responses kind of competing for each other. And maybe they're not needed in that situation, but that's not happened in a vacuum. That's maybe happened as a response to something that's happened previously. And we're still, for whatever reason, holding that threat response.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think back, and we're not talking that long ago, but I remember back when I trained as a counsellor, trauma, there was a very definitive box of what trauma was. Trauma was people who had served in war zones, people who had experienced something incredibly violent, people who had been assaulted in any way, shape or form, people who had experienced a sudden and horrendous death of someone they loved. That was it. That was pretty much trauma. And I remember sitting in a classroom and hearing, as you say, you know, those textbook definitions of trauma includes X, Y, Z. The symptoms of trauma are A, B, C. And looking at them and thinking, there's so much of that I resonate with. But I haven't experienced any of these things. I can't class myself as having experienced trauma. And then going out there into the world as a therapist and working with people, I would hear them talk about those things that were textbook cases of trauma, absolutely, and that were horrendous, but also hear them come out with very, very similar feelings, very similar kind of responses to things that were not in those textbooks. And it almost, hearing those people almost validated me as well, because I suddenly went, trauma is so much bigger and broader than we understand. And I think only now are we starting to really understand what it means and what that's all about. So I love that definition.
So much so. I think that's spot on, that the definition seems to be expanding and kind of becoming more multidimensional all the time. So this idea of systemic trauma, there's loads of kind of new research at the moment around poverty and trauma, and this idea of, you know, to live in poverty is traumatic, not only because to live in poverty potentially makes you more vulnerable to experiencing yourself or having in your immediate circle people in addiction, domestic violence, all those kind of things. There's well documented links around that. But just the experience of being in poverty is traumatic for your system on a bodily level, on sort of holding uncertainty, all that kind of thing. If we relate it back to that idea of what your nervous system can handle, that is absolutely traumatic. So this idea of systemic trauma that happens over a longer period of time, so it's not that we are putting a hierarchy on it, but for want of better language, sort of lower level but long enduring, rather than, as you say, those textbook ideas of one horrific event but then it's over and it's about how we move past it, quote unquote. And then all these ideas around sort of ancestral trauma and how we might be holding what generations have gone through before us. Also, vicarious trauma is something I'm reading a lot about at the moment. So this idea of, you know, people who are working with people who've experienced trauma, that in itself can be traumatic. And if we look on a cultural level at the moment, you know, so many people are going through so much kind of holding trauma, and well, what does that mean then when they're working with other people who are trying to heal them, like looking at our sort of health providers, our criminal justice providers, and what that means for our ability to hold those with empathy and with compassion when we know that all those things are compromised when people are holding trauma. So we know that when people have trauma, they might find it more difficult to be empathic, or they might find problems with memory, or they might find temper and mood and sleep being impacted. And if we think, you know, sort of about our criminal justice systems or our healthcare systems, if all of those people or a high percentage of people in those systems are being vicariously traumatized by holding space for people with trauma, sort of culture, what does that mean culturally about our ability to kind of connect to each other and take care of each other and heal each other and ourselves? There's a lot to be said for talking about trauma more, not less, I would say.
100%. So much, and so much to be said for passing out that understanding so that people can understand not just their own trauma, but also the people who they are coming in contact with, they are holding space for, or they are expecting to hold space for them. And who, you know, are struggling from all those things. So true. I think it's really interesting that when you were talking and you mentioned the physical side of it too, because there's this idea, isn't there, that believing that we sort of process our emotional responses, our mental responses within our physical body is some kind of hippy dippy idea. And that always makes me laugh, because I always think, whenever anyone says that, I'm like, you do realize that Sigmund Freud was talking about this about 100 years before Louise Hay mentioned it. Like, all power to Louise Hay, the woman was absolutely amazing. But Sigmund Freud talked about this many, many moons beforehand. It's academically proven, you know, they've done studies on all of this stuff. And I find it so interesting that you talk about that, because I also wonder, given how much trauma we have in our system, in our cultures, in our society at the moment, systematically, personally, individually, vicariously, ancestrally, is it any wonder that there are so many health, I mean, there are so many reasons for the health problems, I know that, but I wonder how much of that adds up to our physical health as well, you know?
I think that's so true, this idea of like embodied trauma, and you know, that great book, The Body Keeps the Score, and all that kind of stuff, of this idea like our embodied experience. It's such an old idea, you know, it's not newfangled, it's not woo-woo, much as I'm not against anything woo-woo or metaphysical, but we see it in the wild, we see it in animals, you know, this idea, like so much of Peter Levine's work is about, you know, wild animals do this version of noticing, reacting and recovering from threat. They have these threat responses, fight, flight, freeze, hide, and they don't get traumatized by it, or not in the same way, especially animals in the wild, I guess a little bit different from sort of animals that are domesticated or partly domesticated. But animals in the wild don't seem to hold trauma or experience trauma despite living in dangerous situations that are often life or death or violent or all the rest of it. And that's because they're processing these responses, their embodied response. Yeah. And I think actually, you know, definitely there's a link there between us holding it in our bodies, but also that idea of that idea being minimized, that idea being dismissed, probably actually only amplifying the problem, because one of the ways we might sort of look to support ourselves is through recognizing and exploring and processing the physical. And if that's really put in this box, as you say, so often in textbooks, trauma, I definitely imagine with this idea of like being almost like a problem only in brain, not in body. And I think to deny the bodily experience is to miss a huge piece of the work, and to also kind of dismiss so much of that person's experience, because so much of it is physical, from like kind of pins and needles to feeling hot to feeling being hyper aware of your physicality, for your physicality being totally numb and disassociated from, like, there's so much information there. If nothing else, it's such a rich source of data that to work with that just gives you so much material.
Definitely. And you know, when you started talking there, it really struck me that idea of wild animals process trauma just immediately, naturally, in the way nature intended them to, and so they don't hold it. With us, we hold it, and that's where the problem lies. That's where we struggle to process. That's where it gets stuck. And it really struck me that almost loops back to our conversation right at the very start, talking about your work as rebel therapy with the people who are not necessarily accepted for being who they are in society. Mm-hmm. Because so often we see that the people who do not tick the boxes for what the dominant society wants us to be, not only are they not welcomed for being who they are, but equally they are, their experiences are minimized because you should just get on with it. You should just be part of this and you should just be able to be like the rest of us. And actually, when the very essence of your being, or the very essences of your being, I guess, to go back to your multifaceted comment, which I loved, the very essences of your being are overlooked and you're told that they're not right, that in itself is pretty traumatic. But then add that onto the fact that when you are kind of, your experiences are poo-pooed because you don't tick a box and look the way people expect you to, or behave the way people expect you to, or love the people that someone expects you to, you know, those experiences are diminished because they're not understood, they're not accepted. How then can can any trauma you experience be accepted also? And then how can it be processed?
I think that's so right. This idea of sort of like cultural and systemic gaslighting is definitely a thing that happens. And like you're just saying, how can it be processed? And so much of the time in my work, it seems to be that a huge part of processing and healing and recovering from trauma is around reestablishing our own understanding of what safety means for us, of what trust in ourselves means for us, and trusting safety when we find it, and defining that and all of that. And that if you've got, you know, decades of experience of having your trust in yourself systematically undermined, denied, being convinced that it's wrong through all sorts of different sources, that is going to potentially be harder. So I think that there is real need to kind of recognize that those cultural factors are at play when people are maybe exploring stuff, for instance, around their appearance, let's say, to pull an example out of the air. I think it would be almost edging into like offensive to not recognize that we're in a system that is presenting some really dominant, strong ideas about what is how it is acceptable to look and what you should do. And, you know, to go against that is challenging, more challenging for some than others, and that's not to blame them. That usually is about what they have been through and what messages they might have internalized. But, you know, I think that establishing trust in ourselves is so important, and to have that trust undermined or taken away entirely is in itself, as you say, traumatic, and can definitely compound any trauma that is already there.
Definitely, definitely. So interesting, isn't it? So interesting. And as we're talking about it, it makes me feel, I'm conscious that I feel really sad as we're talking about it, that we have, as a world, as a society, we have become so good at traumatizing one another and at not honoring each other and honoring each other's experiences. But then again, it makes me feel very optimistic to think that we're having these conversations, and not just us, but these conversations are being had elsewhere too. And I think that's got to lead to something positive. It's got to lead to change.
I think that's so right. And I love the podcast episodes that you did around sort of social media and digital tools for that exact reason, that although there can be downsides of those tools and we have to be thoughtful about how they use them, but what they have done is really empowered people to be able to not feel isolated in their belief. You know, if you've got a belief system, if you've got something you're coming across, if you are from any kind of subculture or like non-normative, for want of a better phrase, identity, chances are that using the internet, using digital tools, you'll be able to connect to at least someone else, if not numerous someone else's. And that can go such a long way in terms of, you know, so much of trauma is isolation, it's shame, it's secrecy, it's internalizing, and then there can be a lot of self-blame and self-criticism and all that kind of stuff. So I think actually being able to connect to each other, and the rise of sort of interesting things like sort of be it paganism or witchy things, that can't be an accident in a cultural look that's really like systematically disempowering people, that people are seeking out these things that are not new, that are really ancient, but feel feel really relevant, feel really powerful, and people are being drawn to them because of this idea of empowering themselves and finding community, finding family across geographic lines, across sort of class lines, across gender lines, all that kind of stuff. That feels, I can totally understand why that feels really attractive and feels exciting and feels like it could be a source of some quite potent healing.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny because just before we started talking this morning, I was having a conversation with a friend. We were talking about her sort of views on authority and how, you know, traumas in her young life had really impacted her views on authority and her sort of relationship with authority, I guess. And it made me think back to the podcast episode I did with Megan Waterson, where she was talking about this idea that once upon a time, our societies, our belief systems were what she called a sophiology, where we looked into ourselves and found the wisdom and the forgiveness and the security and the safety and the validation within ourselves. And actually what changed one of the biggest, foundations of patriarchy, if we want to call it that, was that we became an eschatology, which was all about having to go to someone outside of yourself and ask for forgiveness and ask for validation and ask for connection to something greater, all of those things. And it just, that really resonated and came back to me when you were talking that actually this is part of what you said about trauma, isn't it? It's about understanding that almost what trauma does for us and what society is systematically doing to many, many, many people and has been for generations is removing us further and further from that idea of sophiology, from that idea of being able to find our sanctuary within us, and instead forcing us to look outside of ourselves, but not even giving us a safe and secure authority, relationship, whatever, to be able to find that.
Yeah, you're so right. That sort of is so disempowering, isn't it? And that links into sort of the capitalist element of it, of that idea of being sold and of a cure, be that in the form of, you know, those sort of numbing things like clothes and food, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of both those things. But that idea of not trusting ourselves, it's valuable for the authorities to have us not trusting ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. But actually, I would argue that, not with you, I would argue with society, that what that does is that further compounds that systematic trauma, and it further compounds any other trauma we have within us.
So much.
Which is infuriating, frankly, if I'm honest. That's the only word I can think of in my mind right now. So I wonder, there are a lot of people, I'm conscious, who are in a place of trauma, who have experienced trauma in their life in whatever way, shape or form that is, who will sit there and think, they may be listening to this, they may have thought this previously, you know, whatever it is, and think, you don't understand. You two are talking about this, that must be really lovely. However, you don't understand, this is something I have carried with me. This is a place I have been stuck in my entire life, or for as long as I can remember. I cannot just fix it. It doesn't work like that. And I wonder what would you, from your experience, what would you say to someone like that? What would your response be to that?
That's a great question. I think so much about the sort of first stages of working with trauma, and maybe about recognizing need. And so for that person, if what they need, it's not saying let go of that baggage necessarily, not straight off the bat, that might feel impossible, that in itself might feel like a really frightening concept. So it might be about what would it feel like if you could just feel a millimeter, a percentage more safe or more resilient with this. You know, if you're hanging on by your fingernails, what could we do, either independently or with the support of a therapist or someone else, like what can be done to grow those fingernails by another millimeter? What can be done to make them feel that bit stronger? So it's not about saying, just climb up, you're fine. If you're hanging on by your fingernails, that's not helpful. So maybe there's something in around recognizing what is safety for that person. So when do they feel most safe? And that in itself could be a massive piece of work that feels really weird and uncomfortable and painful and risky to even go near, but understanding when do they feel the most safe, So that might be around specific environments. I know you posted on your Instagram quite a few times about sort of the woods being really important for you. It might be specific people that they feel really safe with. It might be, they might know that when specific needs are being met, that really helps them. So this idea of how people show love or safety. So, you know, if someone's looking after them, if they have got someone who cooks some food every now and then, that could be really valuable to that person, because, you know, food can be such an association of kind of comfort and safety and having a physical need met. So I guess the first bit would be around, what does safety mean, so that we can have that real conscious understanding of, okay, so when you need safety, where is it? What does it look like? What does it feel like? And that can be the literal thing of having a place to go, having people to go to, but it might be about self-soothing things that they can do for themselves.
Yeah.
So any sort of sensory experience, often trauma kicks us out of our bodies and into our heads because it makes us feel like it's too dangerous to be in our body. You know, we just talked about that, even though while they're experiencing all these bodily experiences, like feeling hot or pins and needles, quite often head is racing as well.
Yeah.
So anything that can ground back into sort of sensory body experience. So anything I do and exercise with clients around, just sort of, okay, let's stop, take a few breaths. Tell me some things that you can hear right now. Traffic outside, the cat snoring, whatever it is. Can you smell anything? What are you touching? So that's the texture of the chair, or, you know, your shoes are too tight or whatever. So it doesn't necessarily have to be comfort in the sense of it being pleasurable, but just sort of coming back into your body. I know, like, smell is a massive one in terms of connection to memory. So if they can take a sort of agency over that process, so having something, quite a few of my clients like to have a bit of piercing, but on a sleeve. So it's not on their body, but it's like they can just sniff it, like on the cuff of a sleeve or something, so that they've got that option at any time to smell something that's comforting, and that can kind of ground you back in your body. So understanding what safety is for them.
Yeah,
I think is such a massive piece of it. And then perhaps if it feels safe to do, exploring how do they know when they're not safe. And so that's a piece of work around recognizing where, if they wobble, where will they feel that? Where, how will they know when they're hopefully not all the way over, but when they're just starting to wobble, how does that show up for them? And again, that'll be different for everyone. But, you know, if someone has had trouble with addiction, say, it might be that even if they're not tipping back in or not a relapse, but it might be they feel the temptation stronger of old addictive patterns. Some people might isolate themselves and they know that that's the pattern that they do. So I suppose it's knowing what will support rebalance and reconnection, which I think is something you talk a lot about on this podcast really beautifully. And that it's self-compassion, it's patience, and I guess developing as much self-understanding and as much self-compassion more than anything to start with. And then all that other work might feel slightly more approachable if safety and self-protection at least feels like it's been considered.
Yeah.
That's a really good foundation.
Definitely. Do you know what I found fascinating there when you were talking? It really struck me that I've been really getting a bee in my bonnet over the last, well, for ages it seems, but certainly over the last few months, about the fact that so many of the practices, so many of the themes that I have personally found so fundamental to my healing and to my sort of coming back to a place of feeling more whole within myself. And that also I find so incredibly important when I work with clients who are also trying to come back to their wholeness after challenges, after traumas, after all of these different experiences. So many of them are turned into kind of insta cliches almost. I talked recently on the podcast about self-love and how I think self-love has become, you just need to put yourself a bubble bath with some candles. That's self-love. And it's for some people it is, and sometimes it is, but not for every person, not for every moment. And what I found fascinating there when you were talking was that actually a lot of the things you were talking about, in order to make ourselves feel secure, in order to help ourselves to feel safe, in order to reconnect with ourselves, recognize those moments of kind of tipping, of wobbling, we need to know what it is to make ourselves feel safe. We need to know what we need to feel nourished, to feel loved, to feel cared for. And actually it shows the depth of importance of that kind of topic, doesn't it? That it's not just about doing something nice so that you can do hashtag self-care Sunday. Although of course that's important if that's what you need to do. It's about understanding what you need to feel safe and secure and loved and nourished in any given moment that you need that.
I think that's such a good way of putting it. So understanding what need we're meeting by doing that. So that idea of, like, I'm a big fan of journaling. I love it. I do it myself. I advocate for it in my clients. You've talked about it on the podcast before. And that idea of, yeah, that's a great thing to do in and of itself, but what need is being met there? And that'll really vary depending on the day, the person, and what they're exploring through that journaling. But that idea of that can meet a need that you could be exploring through that process. Okay, what does safety look like for me? What does it feel like for me? How will I know when I'm safe? Yeah. How do I feel like I know when I'm not safe? Is that something I trust myself with? So all that self-exploration and self-understanding, that's a really self-compassionate thing to do. And that might be harder work. That might be uncomfortable. That might be when you need the bubble bath after that, as a sort of, you know, again, coming back to body, supporting kind of sensory experience, all that kind of stuff. You know, just physical warmth and relaxing is it's so important. But that idea of, I don't think we can necessarily just bubble bath ourselves to trauma recovery. I think it also has to go hand in hand with kind of this real self-exploration, self-understanding, potentially re-establishing some really fundamental concepts for ourselves of what is love, what is safety, you know, all that kind of stuff are things that might have become, through no fault of our own, very warped kind of warped definitions, might have become really internalized. So doing that work of re-establishing and re-choosing, which I think is something that is not necessarily recognized in society as much as it should, that we get to claim our own definitions of these things. And then once we know what they are, it's a much shorter walk potentially to put them into practice. If we don't know what we are, what they are, what we are, or what those definitions are, that's a lot harder to advocate for ourselves for. It's a lot harder to kind of put things into place in our life that support those things. So I think the more self-understanding and self-compassion we have, that can only be a great foundation to build on for the rest.
100%. Because I think, and you touched before on, you know, on this podcast, we talk a lot about that idea of reconnection with the self, of self-understanding, of reconnection with actually what is right for us, what is important for us. Because from my opinion, that's where everything starts. It's where we start to work on healing what's gone before. It's where we start to work on changing the world, is by working on how we sort of need to show up as ourselves in the world and what we need from the world. And I wonder, and I think in doing that, there is so much potential, as you say, to be able to work through trauma and understand it, and then work to kind of feel more safe within ourselves and within the world. But equally, there is such a threat, isn't there? And as therapists, of course, we're both going to say this, but I firmly believe that it's so important to have someone there, to have someone who can hold you through that, who can keep you safe through that, who can be that kind of external point of safety and that kind of solid base, if you like, as you're doing that work. However, we all know that there are times when that isn't possible, be that for reasons of finances, be that for various other reasons. And so I wonder, you talked there about the exercise you run through with clients in terms of being in your body, getting into your body. If you were talking to somebody who is running through this place of reconnecting with themselves and stumbles across something that is an absolute, this doesn't just make me wobble, it makes me tip into full, spiraling back into that trauma response place, what would your advice be to them if they couldn't seek out support from someone else, or if, I don't know, maybe they were waiting to seek out for support for whatever reason, they just had that time by themselves first? How would you advise someone to kind of hold themselves through that process, I guess?
I'd say, so one that I love for my own use and that I use a lot with clients is a sort of CBT approach, which it's called the ABC model. You're probably familiar with it already, but it's this idea of things happening in sequence. So the A is an activating event, triggering a belief, triggering a consequence. now in sort of neuroscience terms, which I know you had Rich Lister on not so long ago speaking about really beautifully about like kind of the neuroscience of how we develop habits and patterns of reacting without necessarily it feeling like we've consciously made a decision or we're consciously choosing that belief. Yes. So from a neuroscience perspective, that can all be say neurons that fire together, wire together. So when we experience it, it might feel like it's happening instantly. So A happens, the event, and then we're in consequence C. Yeah, so we're, whatever that consequence is, be it feeling panicked or I've got to get out of here, whatever that is, or it might even just be the consequence, not just, but a less intense physical reaction might be feeling a certain way about ourselves. But in the middle, there's a B, and we don't consciously necessarily move through it because usually it's something from the past, potentially. Mm-hmm. So there's a belief there. So this idea of, say, the event being a slam door mm-hmm. might trigger in some people. I mean, this is something that I still have quite a lot of problem with, is slam doors can make me panic, mm-hmm. right? And it's this idea of somewhere along the line, this is... to reveal a bit about myself, is growing up in quite a violent household, is that slam doors, the belief is this means arguments, this means it's going to kick off, meaning not safe. Yeah. So as a self-protection strategy, consequence being get out, get out, yeah. get out, it's not okay here. Yeah. And the consequence of that being either trying to get out, which would be completing the threat response of flight, mm-hmm. or getting ready to fight. But because I can, to a degree, recognize that that is not necessary, that threat response now in the present. So I'm kind of limiting that threat response being yeah. able to be completed. So then I'm holding all this energy, which then will come out in, say, being irritable or yes. shouting myself, like, don't slam that door, like yeah. whatever, or, you know, just feeling a bit panicked and sort of repressing that and then holding that internally. So all that to say is that idea of, if it's possible for someone, perhaps exploring, not necessarily in the moment, unless that does feel accessible, but maybe after the fact of trying to get into what did I believe in that moment? What was that about? Mm. So usually we can say what the event was and we can say what the consequence was, but B sometimes requires a bit of digging.
Yeah.
So exploring into that, be it through journaling, be it through talking to someone who's trusted, be it even just talking to ourselves. I do a lot of talking to myself in the car and things like that. In a safe space, a contained yeah. safe space, you know.
The car is the safest space, isn't yeah, it? No one can see you when you sing and dance in your car. It's all good.
Exactly. I'm literally surrounded by metal. You're in charge of the music, the heat, you yeah. know, from an environmental, being able to control your environment. Anyway. Can't necessarily control what's beyond the car, but yes, something, I think there is something in that. So that idea of feeling into the belief, and that in itself can generate so much kind of self-understanding. It, I think, even though it might feel instant by splitting it out into a sequence, that can help us sort of slow down and feel into it. It's not that I'm crazy that I hear a slam door and I, you know, jump out my skin or scream or whatever that is. It's a sequence of events that's being triggered, you know, trigger in the very literal sense of the word. It's the catalyst of the activating event is setting off a sequence of events. So just yeah. kind of breaking it into a linear thing, even though it doesn't necessarily feel linear in the moment, that can be really useful. And then maybe feeling into, are there any parts of this sequence that are in my control?
Yes.
So that might be around working on the belief. If you're able to identify a belief that maybe I can kind of challenge this mm. around, you know, maybe a slam door now doesn't mean I'm unsafe. Maybe it just means I work in an office with people who are inconsiderate and the doors are, should be soft closing doors, but are not, you know, like yeah. I've worked in places. I think I was telling you before we started recording that I worked in a women's center and then changing the doors from soft, hard closing, loud, noisy doors to soft closing doors made such a difference in terms of the therapeutic work that I was yeah. wild that it had not been done before. So this idea of, you know, you can maybe tackle the A, maybe that is in your control. So, you know, for instance, if it's something in a partnership that you feel safe in and something's triggering that idea of, to keep using this analogy of, all right, well, maybe it's possible for me to say, mate, you need to not slam that door.
Yeah.
Just while I work on this. And it, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's in our power in a global sense, in every environment, but maybe we can minimize the instances of it being triggered. Mm. Maybe it's around working on that belief and challenging our understanding of what that means in it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's around the consequence, and that is really hard, but it might be about bringing in some of those self-soothing strategies.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily that we can prevent the consequence initially, but it might be then what do we do when we feel the consequence? Yes. This is why I think that self-compassion piece is so important, because when I often do this exercise with clients and we kind of map it out, I've got a big whiteboard in my rooms, and very, very frequently what happens is one of the consequences, as well as these physical reactions and all that kind of thing, is, and then I feel shit about myself, or I feel stupid, or I feel like I should be over it, or I feel all this internalized shame and all that kind of stuff. And that then just setting off another round of the sequence, that C, the consequence, becomes the A in another round of, and then when I feel rubbish about myself, my belief is I'm no good, I'm this, I'm that, and the consequence is I want to fall back on old addictive habits, or I feel the temptation to soothe myself with sex or drugs or whatever it is. And it just kind of self-perpetuating itself. So by kind of at least looking at, are there any elements of this that are in my control? And even if they don't feel in my control, at least can I come to understand them better?
Yeah.
And maybe that will allow me to set things up, be it that I have a friend who rings me after, say it's after I do something that's difficult. So I know that on this day at work, it's going to be really hard because this person pushes my buttons. That's only a weekly meeting. Can I arrange for it to ring me on a Monday night so that I've got a bit of space to process that, or whatever, you know? So perhaps there's things that can be sort of established while we're doing that work, so it doesn't feel so overwhelming.
Yeah. There's so much of that that's so powerful. And it's so interesting to hear you talk through it. And thank you for sharing your experience as well, because it provides such an interesting insight, I think. And it's interesting to talk through it, because so often that B part can be so subconscious, or unconscious, I should say. It can be so unconscious that we don't even recognize it. We just immediately go into a slam door makes me do this without stopping and saying, okay, but how? And if afterwards we can do that, we gain so much insight. And I always say in my work with clients that when you are working with stuff from the past, with traumatic stuff from the past, sometimes it's a bit like the end level of a computer game. You know, when you have to fight the big bad guy on a computer game, and the first time you do it, it's really bloody hard. But then after you've done it two or three times, you know which way he's going to move, you know how he works. So the next time around, it becomes that bit easier because you know your enemy, you know what you're dealing with. And I think sometimes dealing with our trauma triggers and helping to process that trauma, be that on our own, be that with support from a professional such as yourself, it needs that, doesn't it? It needs that understanding. Because once we know how that operates, and let's be honest, our traumas are not the experiences themselves, while not nice and not pleasant and not something we ever want to repeat, the responses that our body has to them are not bad things. They are conditioned responses that we've done to try and keep ourselves safe. You know, that our body, that our mind is created to keep us safe. But the more we can understand them, the more we can work through them, work with them. And that's the crux of it, isn't it?
I think that's such a great analogy, that idea of like the boss in the computer game and being able to anticipate what how they will move and what energy we need. And, you know, that bit's going to, you know, that always takes however much sort of life percentage, you know, to use that kind of I need to be on full capacity to deal with that. And that idea of maybe small things that we can do, you know, you're like your power-ups in a computer game, as it were, might make us feel more able to do that, more empowered, or just having that bandwidth, that resilience. I mean, to use an example, one of the settings that I've done youth work in is doing creative exercises, creative writing, but with a group of sort of ex-offenders, so young people who've been in juvenile detention centres and things like that, and co-facilitating with people, recognising that the group was really struggling, like attention was really a thing, and noise and all that kind of stuff. And then at a certain point throughout this project, they made someone recognized, and then it became a thing of why did no one recognize this earlier, that in this setting where we were working, quite a few of the members of the staff had big bunches of keys on their belts, and it was potentially the idea of the keys jangling, not consciously, being a trigger or activating old memories or old senses of being trapped or being any number of things that they might have told that they were in that context. And once it was made policy that staff had to secure their keys on an inside pocket or elsewhere in their clothing, the attention went up, the engagement in the activities massively went up. So it definitely made a difference. And it was that idea of, you know, sometimes, by no means did that solve any of the things that those people might have been holding or trying to understand. It didn't mean that it was no longer there, but it potentially freed up a lot of energy or resource or resilience that was being expended in that moment, in that threat response, in sort of all that kind of stuff. It just meant that a deeper level of engagement, healing could be accessed because some of the triggers had been removed. So where it is possible to remove triggers, by all means, do you know what I mean? I think that is not to be understated. I think often I can read things about, well, it's not possible to remove all triggers in the world, so people just have to learn to cope with trigger. But I'm like, but so if it is possible, why would you deny someone that opportunity to have that bit of relief? You know, yes, it isn't possible in the wider world to protect, to eliminate everything that might upset us. So if in this space we can make it feel safe, or if there's anything they can do for themselves to make it feel more comfortable as they navigate the world as someone who might be holding whatever they're holding, why would we not facilitate that?
Yeah, completely. Because it's about that. It goes back to what we said earlier. It's about giving someone that safe place. It's about enabling yourself to feel as safe and secure as you can possibly feel in order to do that work. And I often think, really, with our jobs, that's the fundamental principle of it, isn't it? Just giving somebody a safe place to be them. And the work that unfolds from there will unfold. What unfolds will unfold. But the crux of it is having that safe place. Completely.
Totally that. And the layers that, you know, you can go around things potentially again and again and discover new learning and discover new complexities to it each time, but without the space to even go around it once.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily peel the onion down to that, like the most core level, unless you've done that other work, you know, whether that's on your own, whether that's with the support of someone else, having the space and time and safety to do that is what will fundamentally support the rest of the process.
Yeah, definitely. I love that you mentioned there in your, as you were talking about that, you mentioned the word triggered a few times. And I think triggered's one of those words I find really interesting, because in this context, it has such a, an important meaning, and it's such an important thing to be aware of what our triggers are, how we respond to our triggers when it comes to dealing with our own traumas. And yet triggered has become something that is, we say it, we throw it around like confetti, don't we? Oh, that triggers me. I'm so triggered by this. And it's like, and it's almost come to the point that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that term actually means. So I love that you actually said it is a literal trigger. One action leads to a response. You kind of spelled it out. And I think the feeling of that being triggered, the things that trigger us will be different for everyone. You mentioned the slamming doors. You know, I could go on about this with many different things, but I had a real issue. I had a horrendous car accident a few years ago. And it wasn't until one day I realized that every time I got in the car and put the keys in the ignition, my anxiety would spike and I would shake. And I was suddenly like, how did I not know that getting into a car was such a big trigger? But again, I think for the longest time, we have been told that a trauma trigger looks like this. And it doesn't necessarily look the same for everyone, does it? But from the perspective of thinking about those trauma responses and thinking about that ABC model, how do we recognize a trigger? How do we recognize those wobbles that threaten to tip us over the edge, I guess?
So for me, there's something about it like kicking us in, something that kicks us into a mode that is not the mode that we were in before we came up against that
Yep.
So that might feel like a change in mood. It might feel like a change in our physical experience, but usually it's something that is jarring us out of the mode that we're in and into a different mode. And usually it being a sort of threat response mode, a fight, flight, freeze, hide. Usually if we're going into that mode without there necessarily being an immediate obvious threat, then it's a trigger. So there's a great book called The Invisible Lion by a guy called Benjamin Fry, and he uses this analogy of, if you see someone running down the street screaming their head off and you can't see any obvious reason why, potentially that would be quite frightening, and we might still have empathy for them, we might still have concern for them and want to make sure that they're okay, but it would be quite jarring. It would maybe feel quite frightening that it was inexplicable. But if we see a lion, we see that person running down the street, they're screaming, they're crying, they're running for their lives, and we see a lion chasing after them, well, it suddenly makes sense. Yeah. You know, we'll still have empathy, we'll still be concerned, but no longer will we feel that fear, because their response makes total sense in context, that they've seen a threat and they're trying to get away from it.
Yeah.
And I think that is when we recognize a trigger, is that we've gone into threat response, but there's not necessarily an immediate obvious threat.
Yeah. That makes me think, talking about that invisible lion story, which I love, makes me think, I guess this takes me back a little way to near the start of our conversation, but it makes me think about the validation of our traumas for ourselves, because again, we are told that trauma looks a certain way. Again, outside of a therapy room, often if you express your trauma, what you find to be traumatic and what you find to be a trigger to other people, in a society that is not aware of trauma, I don't know, is this gaslighting? Is it just a complete lack of awareness, possibly the latter, that other people won't necessarily get it? And that doesn't mean that it isn't traumatic. It doesn't mean that it is not, it doesn't mean that it is not going to have a hell of an impact on you when it happens. You know, your triggers are your triggers, and they don't have to look like anyone else's triggers. They don't have to be a walking, breathing, roaring lion to be a lion to you. Sometimes they can be a teeny tiny little kitten to someone else, but it's a lion to you.
Yeah, I think there is definitely something about that self-understanding of recognizing and validating for ourselves, and having that be a practice for ourselves, and understanding our own patterns of how we, to keep using that analogy of like the patterns we might have established to keep that lion at bay. So for instance, it's like we feel the lion roaring in the distance, and our response, it might be to run. But we might have also learned other things. So it might be that, like, by comfort eating, we keep that feeling at bay. And again, it's not to say that there's anything wrong with that of itself, but it's this idea of, and where did we learn that? It might be that we're from a family that eats rather than talks about things. And again, there's nothing necessarily wrong, you know, with that as a strategy. But if then that means that we feel like we're breaking the rules, that in itself can be a trigger. So that idea of what have we internalized, and how can we make that okay for ourselves?
Yeah, exactly. How do we, I almost think, you know, when it comes to those coping strategies, is there something about, again, this brings back the shame piece, but is there something about acknowledging that it's okay? And I guess we've said this in a couple of ways, but we haven't probably hit on it right on it. Is there something about recognizing that your coping mechanisms, I've read this somewhere, but at some point in time, your coping mechanisms helped you, they helped you through, and we don't have to feel guilty or ashamed or bad or any of those things, or silly or any of those things, because in the moment that we feel that trigger, we reach for the pack of biscuits. Actually, we need to accept that those biscuits, once upon a time, they helped. They are still trying to do a job. And all right, that might not be a coping mechanism that is potentially, depending on what it is and how it's being used, it might not be healthy for us right now on every level. It might be something that we're going to change. But actually, I almost think in order to change that pattern, there is an element, and maybe this is part of the, it's part of that ABC model that you talked about. There is an element of almost having to forgive ourselves, thank ourselves for being able to self-soothe in some way. Thank ourselves, maybe that's not the right word, but forgive ourselves for the way that we did self-soothe before we try and change that.
I think that's exactly right. That idea of you don't need to punish yourself for meeting or trying to meet your own needs, mm-hmm. even if the way you've done it is not always been the best, quote unquote. Yes. It might have been what was available to you at that time, and it might be something that when you have more capacity, you can explore that and see if that is something you want to continue with. But I don't think, you know, as we've talked about, the sort of cultural and systemic factors, like, we're up against enough in the world. I don't think we need to compound that by punishing ourselves for just trying to make ourselves feel safe, even if what the way that we were doing it was by eating a packet of biscuits, when maybe that was a way of numbing certain feelings that felt too uncomfortable to hold. If we didn't feel comfortable or able or safe enough to hold those feelings in that moment, and our strategy was to numb them, to push them away, to dissociate from them, that's really understandable. Like, it's not, when I say that's okay, it's not to say don't do anything about it.
Yes.
There's possible ways that that can be explored or felt into and potentially challenged if someone decides that's what they want and what they need. But it's also understandable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's that acceptance of self, isn't it? And that acceptance that at any given time, we're doing the best that we can. And where we want to get to, I guess, with this self-awareness, with this self-reconnection, with this self-compassion, is about being able to do that in a different way for ourselves that almost makes us feel more broadly secure, I suppose.
Yeah, so secure on a more day-to-day, moment-to-moment sense, rather than creating a perhaps artificial version of security through those strategies like sex or food or whatever it might be for that person.
And being able to find that within ourselves rather than looking outside to all of those things.
I think that's spot on.
Thank you so much for all of that wisdom. It was just juicy, I think is the best word. I feel like I'm going to have food for thought for the whole rest of the day, Jane. Thank you.
Oh, likewise. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So tell me, if people want to find out more about you, if people want to work with you, if people want to come and write with you in the Peak District, which I absolutely want to do, how do they find out more about you and the work that you do?
Fab. Okay. So probably the best way to keep in touch with all of those things in one place is to follow me on Instagram, where I'm Jane Claire Bradley. So plain Jane, J-A-N-E, and then Claire with an I and Bradley with an E-Y. All one word. That's probably the best. Then information about me as a multifaceted human to tap into, that thing that we've talked about a little bit over the course of this session, is janeclairebradley.com is my sort of personal website. Okay. So that's bits about writing, bits about the other sort of facilitation work and workshops and stuff that I do. Hopefully some news about my book as and when that comes. And then my therapeutic practice, which is also linked to from those other places, but that's rebel-therapy.com as well.
Fabulous. And I will link all of those in the episode notes for this show too, so that people can make it nice and easy. So with all of that said, thank you so much for all of your time, Jane, for all of your wisdom. It has been an absolute pleasure, and yeah, maybe we'll have to do this again and talk capitalism next time.
Yeah. My forever bugbear, it's never far from my lips as something to acknowledge and talk about and rail against. So absolutely. But thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to The Divine Feminist. If you'd like to know more about today's episode, check out the show notes below. If you want to know more in general, head over to Instagram, where it's @divine.feminist, or to my website, karenroundtree.com/divinefeminist. I'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. But until then, I'd love to hear from you. So please get in touch if you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions of what you'd like to hear. If you don't want to miss out on future episodes, be sure to subscribe in your favourite podcast store. And hey, if you feel so called, maybe give us a rating there too. Ideally 5 stars. Until next time though, Thank you and take care.